Coming up, Barefoot College in India, where illiterate women learn enough engineering to light up their villages with solar power. And writer Kathleen Norris in a candid exploration of her personal spiritual wilderness.
The last 10 years, I would say, have been really rough.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. New religious and ethical debates this week after President Barack Obama cleared the way for federal tax dollars to fund expanded embryonic stem cell research. Obama said funding such research is morally necessary because of the potential to find medical cures.
As a person of faith, I believe we are called to care for each other and work to ease human suffering. I believe we have been given the capacity and will to pursue this research, and the humanity and conscience to do so responsibly.
The Catholic Church and several other religious groups oppose that research because it destroys the embryo, which they consider tantamount to killing an innocent human life. Joining me with more is David Mashey, Senior Research Fellow at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. David, how controversial is this within the religious community?
Well, there are a range of different opinions in the American religious community. Jewish denominations and mainline Protestant churches, particularly more liberal mainline Protestant churches, support embryonic stem cell research. They say that embryos have intrinsic value and worth, but the incredible possibilities that stem cell research offer, cures for cancer and things like that, outweigh those concerns and considerations. On the other side, you have the Roman Catholic Church, and you have more evangelical Protestant churches like the Southern Baptist Convention or the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church. These churches oppose embryonic stem cell research. They say an embryo is a person. And a person has the right to life, and you can't take that right away, even for the best of reasons.
What about the people in the pews? Do they agree with the leadership of these institutions?
White evangelical Protestants tend to support their church's positions on this. Only 31% of evangelicals support embryonic stem cell research. So a substantial majority say, no, we don't want embryonic stem cell research. With Catholics, it's the other way around. 59% of American Catholics support embryonic stem cell research, which, of course, goes exactly against what the church's leadership is saying. Now, when you ask Catholics who attend Mass regularly, weekly, whether they support embryonic stem cell research, that number drops to 46%. So people actually in the pews, people who are attending Roman Catholic services, they do, they are more likely to support their leadership's views on this than Catholics as a whole.
What about the issue of adult stem cells? There are some opponents of embryonic stem cell research that say this is a way of getting the stem cells without destroying the embryo, and therefore it might be an ethical alternative. Is that indeed a viable alternative?
It might be. I think that's the right way to put it. Scientists tell us that they've made an enormous number of strides, especially recently in this area. They've been able to reprogram skin cells, for example, to act like embryonic stem cells so that they can be used in all different kinds of ways. But scientists also say that these cells and embryonic stem cells, in both cases, they're not really ready for medical therapy yet. They haven't reached the point where they feel confident that they can do all the things that they hope they can do. So their position, scientists are saying, you know what we need to do is work in both areas, with adult stem cells and with embryonic stem cells. On the other hand, you have some opponents of embryonic stem cell research saying adult stem cells are clearly the way to go. They eliminate the ethical considerations, and given the advances that have been made recently, it's clear that that's where we're headed in terms of this therapy.
All right. David Mashey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim.
We'll continue this conversation online at pbs.org. In other news, religious activists called on Congress and the administration to do more about the spiraling foreclosure crisis. The faith-based PICO network sponsored a cross-country bus caravan of what they called recovery riders. The riders ended up in Washington, D.C. this week, where they held a prayer vigil and lobbying session urging more government policies to help struggling homeowners.
Keeping families in their homes is a justice value, it is a moral value, and it is a family value.
Also in Washington, protesters marked the 50th anniversary of the failed Tibetan uprising against Chinese rule. The demonstration in front of the White House was one of many around the world that commemorated the uprising and called for more autonomy in the region still controlled by China. The Dalai Lama, who was exiled from Tibet as a result of the 1959 events, addressed followers at his base in India. The spiritual leader condemned China's continued religious repression and said that life in Tibet has become hell on earth. This coming week, Pope Benedict XVI heads to Africa for his first trip there since becoming pope. Benedict will visit Cameroon and Angola. He'll celebrate the 500th anniversary of the arrival of Catholic missionaries in sub-Saharan Africa. Meanwhile, the pope is continuing to fend off criticism for reinstating an excommunicated bishop who denies the Holocaust. Benedict sent a highly unusual letter to the world's Catholic bishops in which he admitted that the Vatican had mishandled the episode. Jewish leaders and many others were outraged when Benedict reinstated Richard Williamson, who was one of four ultra-traditionalist bishops allowed back into the church. The pope said he intended reconciliation, but called the ensuing uproar a, quote, misadventure that was unforeseeable. And the church faced controversy on another front as well. Vatican officials defended the actions of Brazilian Catholic leaders in the case of a pregnant 9-year-old girl. She allegedly had been raped by her stepfather and was carrying twins. Doctors feared the 80-pound girl might not survive the pregnancy, so her mother allowed them to perform an abortion. In response, Brazilian church leaders excommunicated the mother and the doctors. A Vatican official said it was a sad case, but called the aborted fetuses innocent victims. We have a story today about an unusual school in India where rural and often illiterate women are learning enough engineering to install and maintain solar power in their villages. It's called Barefoot College. Fred DeSamlazaro reports.
The students are mostly women. Some are grandmothers. Hundreds have come through here from villages across India and a dozen other countries to learn how to install and maintain solar energy in rural areas. Even though it's sophisticated coursework, the only prerequisite for admission to the Barefoot College is that there are no prerequisites, not even to speak the language.
First time. It's the first time they've spoken Arabic.
Until we arrived with a translator, these Mauritanian women, who'd been here 4 months, hadn't spoken to anyone else in Arabic, the only language they know. But language is not a barrier to learning, says the college's founder.
Our job is to show how it is possible to take an illiterate woman and make her into an engineer in 6 months and show that she can solar electrify a village.
Bunker Roy, a social activist influenced by Gandhi, founded the Barefoot College in 1972. He wanted to use traditional knowledge and sustainable technology to help this impoverished desert region. It began with basics, like finding safe drinking water. Then, several years later, solar energy.
In 1986, no one ever thought of solar electrification. It was far too expensive. But today, we have 50 kilowatts of panels on our roofs, all our 20, 30 computers, electronic machine, telephone exchange, all works of solar.
Today, solar energy drives not just the equipment. This is a larger social experiment to improve the lives of some of the world's poorest people. It begins in the classroom, run by instructors who themselves have little or no formal education. Instruction is delivered with a mix of body language, a few essential terms in English, and lots of hands-on practice. The students create an illustrated manual they'll take home. It's the closest thing to a diploma certifying their training as solar technicians. But just coming here is an unlikely achievement for students like 56-year-old Sarka Musara, a widowed grandmother. She'd never attended school or even left her village in the West African nation of Mauritania.
At first, we did not even have a passport. We started little by little learning the solar energy system. Day by day and little by little, we were able to put things together.
I have been to two villages in Mauritania.
Roy was educated at elite Indian schools on a path to medicine or diplomatic service before he founded the Barefoot College. The idea of self-reliant learning was inspired by Mahatma Gandhi, also by a legendary American.
Well, it's Mark Twain who said, never let school interfere with your education. School is something that you learn reading and writing. Education is what you learn from the family, from the environment, from the community.
Using grants from the UN and private foundations, Roy travels extensively in developing countries seeking potential students. He doesn't want city dwellers or, unless they are physically handicapped, men.
We've come to the sad conclusion men are untrainable. They expect too much. They're restless. If they're young, they're impatient. The first thing they ask even before the training starts is, do I get a certificate? They will use that certificate to get the worst job possible in a city. Whereas if we take middle-aged grandmothers to be trained, I don't have that problem of migration.
Their new skills and income should improve these women's standing at home and in community. Communities that, like much of the developing world, are not electrified.
How many houses are in the town?
500.
May God reward you for what you have done, because those people did not have any light, and now they will have light.
And these women will have an income, installing and maintaining solar systems. They are a common sight in villages near the Barefoot campus, where people have replaced lanterns that use dirtier and more expensive fuels.
We said you should pay as much as you pay today for kerosene, for wood, for batteries, for torches, for candles. It comes to about $5 a month. They're willing to pay $5 a month for the use of the solar light.
Solar has opened new opportunities for work and study, especially for girls. In both the majority Hindu and minority Muslim communities here, girls have traditionally been restricted to household chores.
And it's the girls who go and graze the cattle and graze the goats and the sheep. There is a feeling in the family that the boys should be getting better education, whatever that means. So we started the night schools of Thelonia in 1975 purely from the point of view of attracting more girls who graze cattle in the morning to come to school at night.
Today, some 7,000 children attend night school here and across rural North India. In song, these girls plead to their parents to allow them to study, to delay marriage until they turn the legal age of 18. That law is frequently ignored in rural society.
Okay, 8 and 5 make how much?
13.
10 plus 3?
13.
Entertainment programs promote the Barefoot College and encourage children to attend school. There have also been various other campaigns to promote public health and citizen demands for government transparency. The new economic activity seems to be eroding social barriers. For example, several women work to create solar stoves, a Barefoot College enterprise.
The solar cookers made at the Barefoot College are a simple but precisely engineered contraption. These mirrors track, then capture the sun's energy and direct it to a cooker, which really cooks.
For these technicians, most with little or no formal education, working here means they can hope for better things for their children.
My daughter must be educated. She will be able to do things, to progress so much faster than I can because of going to school more. For me, for example, it takes so much more time to measure out 3 centimeters when I'm welding here, whereas someone who is educated could do it in no time.
In our village, in our community, women were not allowed outside the house. My husband was reluctant, but I said if we stay behind the veil, we won't have anything to eat. Some people object to women working, but if we can add income to the household, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Roy says a key to sustaining rural jobs and development is to use technology that can be managed by the local community, like solar lanterns, and technology that's more familiar, like rainwater collectors.
All the roofs of this whole campus are connected underground to a 400,000-liter tank. We collect every drop of rain that falls on the campus.
For Roy, decentralization is the key. It's a departure from the typical approach of aid agencies, which he says want to bring big infrastructure and big ideas created by outside experts.
If you ask an engineer what they think is the solution, they'll have one power plant of 5 kilowatts that you saw on the roofs in the campus, and then have transmission lines going to the houses, centralized. We say no. The solution is decentralized right down to the household level, where the house actually maintains and looks after the solar unit. It shouldn't be centralized. Any technology that brings in dependency on anybody on outside is not a technology that will work.
So far, Barefoot College has solar electrified some 350 villages across India and dozens more in sub-Saharan Africa and even war-torn Afghanistan. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in Rajasthan, India.
New evidence this week that the percentage of Christians in the U.S. has declined, while the number of people claiming no religious affiliation has increased. According to a new survey by Trinity College in Hartford, in 2008, 76% of Americans called themselves Christians, down from about 86% in 1990. And 15% said they had no religion, up from about 8% in 1990. Researchers said declines in mainline Protestant denominations could explain some of the shifts. Poet and writer Kathleen Norris's books have won her many admirers, especially among religious believers. After nearly 10 years of literary silence, she released a new book last year called Acedia and Me. Acedia, Norris says, is a kind of spiritual gloom that she has endured on and off since she was 15. She talked about it with Bob Abernethy.
It's an ancient word that basically means the inability to care, even to the extent that you can't care, that you don't care anymore. It's a sort of a really drastic, nasty form of indifference.
Norris first became popular in the 1990s with a story about her life on the Great Plains, to which she and her husband had moved from New York City. The book was called Dakota. In the Dakotas and then at St. John's Abbey in Minnesota, Norris discovered Benedictine monasteries and the ancient practice of chanting the Psalms 5 times a day. She wrote about monastic life in The Cloister Walk. Next, in Amazing Grace, Norris offered her thoughts on Christian language, and in The Virgin of Bennington, she wrote primarily about poetry. And then, nothing more. The books stopped coming. What happened was that Norris had to become a full-time caregiver. Now, to her 91-year-old mother in Hawaii, where Norris grew up, earlier it was her father who needed care and her sister, and especially her husband David, who suffered severe mental and physical illness for many years until his death from cancer in 2003.
The last 10 years, I would say, have been really rough, and in some senses, this book is a miracle to me because I was able to finish it at all. There were so many temptations, especially after my husband died, to just give up and say, why write at all? Why bother? Which is the ultimate question with Acedia is, why bother? Why care? Why do anything? All thoughts of writing were sort of shoved to the side for me.
Norris thinks Acedia is different from depression.
If I'm depressed, I tend to know the reasons why. With Acedia, there's no cause. It just sort of pops up. And I might wake up in the morning thinking, oh, this is going to be a good day. And then all of a sudden the thought, no, it won't be. And maybe I shouldn't get out of bed.
Slowly, eventually, Norris managed to get back to her book. On the day it was finally published, she was at the Washington National Cathedral, recalling how hard the process had been.
Coming back to the project always felt like climbing a mountain in a raging hailstorm. On more days than I care to recall, I would settle for reading thrillers or even watching America's Next Top Model marathons.
Norris had learned from the Benedictines that one way to combat the indifference of Acedia was praying the Psalms. Other remedies were physical work, exercise, and baking bread. Perhaps most important for her was accepting her family responsibilities.
One of the reasons I decided that I better not have children is because I really didn't want to be in the role of a caregiver. So it's something that's been imposed on me, and I've really had to learn how to cope with that, how to be patient and loving instead of irritable and impatient. And believe me, it is a struggle, and I don't always make it. To think, if I'm with this person, helping them do this ordinary task like going to the bathroom, that's the most important thing I can be doing with my life at the moment, to convince myself of that every day.
One thing that made Norris want to get the book finished and published was her sense that acedia might be a problem for the whole country.
I realized that acedia was not just a personal problem, but really it's one that we suffer as a society. I think we often adopt that attitude of indifference because we're being asked to care about so much, we just are exhausted.
Ever since she was a schoolgirl, Norris found refuge at Hawaii's main public library, from which she borrows and returns books by the bagful. Meanwhile, she says she has also learned a lot from taking care of others.
A friend asked me after my husband died, well, have you lost your faith? And my gut reaction, my instant response was to say, of course not. I mean, people die. This is what happens. That's not God out to get me. That's just a fact of life, is that people die. So it really, it didn't shake my faith, really. It made me feel just more like everyone else in the universe. You know, people you love are going to suffer and die, and you somehow have to learn how to cope with that.
Norris says the opposite of acedia and its most powerful antidote is love.
I think part of the struggle just of everyday life is remembering that the love is there. It's just, it's a constant. And to wake up in the morning and realize that love is there in the world, it's there in your relationships, if I can do that, that's half the battle.
In Honolulu, Norris continues to take care of her mother. She says acedia remains a part of her, something she just has to live with. She would like to write more poems, she says, or in a perfect world, she would follow a book on acedia with a comic novel. But she knows very well that the world is not perfect.
On our calendar this week, on March 17th, Irish and non-Irish alike celebrate the feast day of the ever-popular St. Patrick. Also, the Sikh New Year is Saturday, March 14th. And Baha'is and Zoroastrians prepare for their new year, called Nowruz, which occurs at the spring equinox. The Zoroastrian faith began in ancient Persia, now Iran. Estimates vary widely, but some claim that only as few as 115,000 Zoroastrians remain, most in India, but also in Iran, Europe, and North America. To learn more about how Zoroastrian Americans celebrate Nowruz, we visited the Idun family in Gaithersburg, Maryland.
Happy Nowruz. Nowruz is celebrated at the precise moment that spring arrives. The Prophet Zoroaster's message was very universal, centered around the tenets of good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. The Hafsin table is central to the Nowruz celebration. Sin is one of the letters of the alphabet. Items beginning with the letter Sin are traditionally put on the table. There's a misconception amongst many that, you know, Zoroastrians are fire worshippers. Traditionally, it's customary to pray in front of a fire or pray towards a light source. Light is very significant in the Zoroastrian religion, and it's a sign of knowledge and wisdom.
Not look in the mirror.
We offer the mirror. It's essentially a sign of light. You look in the mirror and you get some rose water, which is very aromatic. You also get to see yourself and see how you look at the beginning of the year.
Good thoughts, good words, good deeds. Humata, Puchta, Havarishta.
I believe in one God, Ahura Mazda. My God allows me to think and to choose what's right and wrong. Asha is the law of nature. And as long as you strive to always follow the path of Asha,
Asha, oh no,
to make sure that you are considering everything in the universe You will make this world a better place for future generations to come.
That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. There's much more on our website, including more of Bob Abernethy's interview with Kathleen Norris and an excerpt from her new book. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from celebrations in India of the joyous Hindu festival of Holi.